Welcome to Blackter. Join me as I examine the best of Black artists in my quest to becoming one myself.
Hello, everyone. I am here with playwright Alicia Harris. Welcome to Blackter, Alicia.
It is my pleasure to be here, Gabe.
So your very, very new play on Sugarland is in its first production and run currently at the New York Theater Workshop. You just had your first preview last night. Is that right?
That is correct.
How'd it go?
It went really well. It's exciting to feel the heartbeat of the play, to feel it start to bloom. It's a very ambitious play in every aspect. It's ambitious in terms of like the scope of the work, the length of the work, and the design and everything, and so many characters that it's just taking a lot to bring together. And I'm really pleased and honored by the way that my collaborators have and are continuing to work very, very hard. So it was great to see it and feel it start to come to life, but I think we all understand that we have a lot of work to do. And I think that by the time we get to opening, it will be a different show. So it's just thrilling to be on the journey.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll talk more about that a little later. But to start, I wanna hear about like when theater and the performing arts, like when did it come into your life?
Theater and the performing arts. I think as a youngster in high school, I definitely was, you know, before then, I've always had a desire to create story. And I remember being a kid one time and putting on this little performance where I basically made up a song as I went along, and I'd made my own confetti and I like threw it out at the end of the song, and it was terrible. My younger brother laughed at me, but I think it's fun that young Alicia already knew that there was something about the theater. There was something about dramatizing something about live performance that felt compelling and like a thing I wanted to be a part of my life. And then, you know, I was in drama club in high school and stuff, but I really started taking it more seriously in college. I was in productions in school. I went to a junior college before I went to the University of Southern Mississippi, and I was studying visual art at the time, but I was very excited about theater. I was in local theater productions. I was in productions at school. And I changed my major when I went to USM from visual art to theater, general theater, and was really focused in those days on acting. So I feel like it's, you know, sort of sprinkled in and out of my life, but from undergrad on, I started taking it much more seriously and started out thinking of myself as an actor and then as a playwright and studying playwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was there a particular show or production that made you say like, okay, now I want to do this for the rest of my life. Like, this is it.
I don't think there was one, but there were a few that stand out. One is that I lived in Biloxi, Mississippi as a youngster in undergrad. And there were a lot of casinos there. And so the tours of Broadway shows would come through there. And I do remember two productions. One was Smokey Joe's Cafe, which was just, is this incredible review of Lieber and Stoller's music that I just fell in love with and saw multiple times. The other, and it's because of the like the magic of the theatricality I had not seen before, was Chicago. And I just remember being enthralled by like the one character playing the entire jury and the way that that character used their body and the staging, the mise-en-scene. I just thought it was so sophisticated and sleek, and the music was incredible. And so those two really stuck out and made me, I don't know, just sort of dig in my heels on like, this is what I want to do. And I want to figure out to do a way to do my version of some of these things.
Yeah. So as a Black woman, specifically in these educational settings growing up, did you find yourself having to work harder to share your voice at the beginning of your career?
Yeah, you know, one of the sticky things is that I found it harder to just hear my voice. I wasn't necessarily being educated in robustly in Black theater makers. It was sometimes like just the same handful of theater makers who are dear and wonderful, Lorraine Hansberry, August Wilson. I discovered Intozaki Shange on my own even. So it was a couple of things. One was that I felt like the people who were educating me, they themselves didn't have tremendous education in what Black theater makers have been doing. And then I felt like the work that I was being called to do and the other actors were being called to do was not the work of these writers as well, of these makers as well. So there just wasn't a great deal of exposure that I was getting from the school that I was paying to go to. I had to go find it for myself. And then certainly the educators didn't have a great deal of cultural competency around who we are and what we do. And even if they were teaching a Wilson play, there wasn't as much knowledge as they would have on like a Shakespearean play, right? Which is, I think students gravely, you know, need very much. So So I and then as a writer, I have been in situations as a writer when I was still in school where I felt like, again, people didn't understand what I was up to because they lacked cultural competency. They don't know anything about Black consciousness. They don't hang out with Black people. They don't know anything about Blackness, but because they've been sort of given the idea, or you know, there's a mythology around whiteness that like white people know best about things. So if someone is a white critic or a white artist, there's a way that they're awarded people have a perception of them as having a level of expertise that isn't necessarily there when it comes to art that is made by artists outside, right, of their group, their racial group. It's challenging. It was challenging as a student to receive feedback from folks and understand, but I just learned to parse through it. You know what I mean? Take the meat and spit out the bone and just, you know, try and suss that out for myself. I think that's really important for a student, for any writer, for any artist.
Yeah, it's interesting how when you're young, sometimes it could also go over your head and you're not even aware that that is happening because that's automatically the dynamic. I went through a lot of that. And sometimes it's like, wow, we are so forced to like to conform to their norm because that's the stereotypical way of doing things. Yeah.
Dominant culture will tell you that it is right and you are wrong every time. The worst thing for me would be for young artists to stop listening to their intuition because of pressures they were receiving from a professor who didn't understand Tupac. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just don't want us to abandon our own culture and our own cosmology because we're being educated by folks who don't know and don't care and aren't curious, you know?
Yeah, so before we get into each of your plays specifically, as someone who has seen your writing, just to talk about your style for a minute, the choices you make to structure your text on the page, the way you do, playing with punctuation, size, all of that stuff. How did you come about writing in this way?
You know, it started when I was in grad school. So I just had this impulse because I think it has largely to do with the fact that I studied visual art before theater. So I think in pictures, right? The picture can provoke something, a word crawling down a page vertically is different to if it's being laid out on the page the way that we typically encounter language. So I just had this impulse, and then I felt like I was being given permission by artists like my mentor in grad school, who's a visual poet and librettist and educator, obviously, named Douglas Kearney, who does a lot. If anyone listening to this wants to Google him, that's K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, and just beautiful, provoking poetry. And he does things with the art of language on a page with typography that I've found very inspiring, and they help to deepen what it is he's saying. Again, they do things that just the word itself encountered in normative fashion could absolutely never do. The other big source of influence was the Bald Soprano. There's a graphic version of the Bald Soprano by Ionesco, which you can also Google. It's a hard book to get your hands on. It's one of those expensive art books. But again, that's a text that you can go and read the Bald Soprano, the normal version, and you can look at that graphic version and you can see for yourself the difference that they make. And so I just want to use every tool in my arsenal, everything that's available to me to influence the reader's experience, to give the reader a very compelling piece of theater that they're holding in their hand, and also to signal to potential collaborators who are bringing the work to life.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about like how actors interpret your work and how it could be somewhat easier to kind of see that language, the way it's structured on the page, and to kind of take it off the page and bring it to life.
Yeah, you know, I think it's been a lot of fun to see actors respond to it enthusiastically. Some actors, I think it's a joy and a gift. They're like really into it. It is an experiment, so I don't know exactly. I just kind of want to play with things, and I do want to see how the visual poetics impact on the performer, right? And I'm actually down to see what it'll do. I don't always know. But I have encountered actors, or heard secondhand, because they don't tell me, that aren't into it. And that's perfectly valid. I could see an actor being like, she's telling me too much what to do. I want to discover for myself. I'm not into that. And I think that that's totally fine.
You know? Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. So Is God Is, what inspired you to write this play?
You know, I came into it knowing that I wanted to write a revenge tale. I wasn't sure what it was. It started out a completely different story. There were no twins. It was one woman. But it was woman-centered, and it just, and I thought I was writing an operetta, or I tried writing an operetta. And the play told me, as I believe that they do, that it wanted to be something else. So I just listened to it. Now, as I write in the beginning of that play, in the foreword, or the notes on the play, it does have included adventures in typography. And one of the mandates I sort of gave myself was like, if you were to write a play that was inspired by ancient Greek tragedy, what would that look like? Like, who would people that landscape for you? What aspects of Greek tragedy are you interested in exploring? And how can you sort of filter that idea or way of storytelling that you've been educated in through your own sensibilities? What does it look like? And I like to bring a lot of my interests together. I'm a greedy woman, I will say. I think that you can write a play that uses tropes from a Western and from a Greek play and from hip hop. I think that that is possible. And I'm not really, you know, for me, it was like, just go for it. Just swing big and write the kind of play you want to read and you want to see. And so I just followed my impulses, and I just allowed myself to be really free in the writing of that play.
Yeah.
So I also, though, just to talk about so I feel like my work is very sociopolitical without being didactic. Like, nobody wants to read a Wikipedia play. Like, I don't want to see that kind of work. I'm not interested. So, but I'm always thinking about misogynoir, for example. I'm always thinking, and that's a portmanteau for those listeners who may not know, it's a portmanteau between the words misogyny and the French word for black noir. And it's a word that means the unique sort of intersection of oppression that Black women experience. So we experience gender oppression and racial oppression. And so I'm always thinking about that for us. And I'm thinking about the ways that the politics of respectability attempt to have such a tremendous stronghold on our lives culturally, and the ways that we're expected to endure, that we in fact gain power and the way that people admire Black women is our ability to like put up with a bunch of crap. And I'm just not interested in that. I wanted to write Black women who totally rejected that and sought eye for an eye justice for themselves and each other, not fighting over a man or their child, but for themselves and each other. It just felt like a really exciting thing to do.
I'm curious what you think about this, the idea of presenting Black joy and or Black trauma on stage, and who gets to identify what that is. What are your thoughts around that?
I think that it's a conversation. So I certainly, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking in that binary at all. I'm trying to tell a really good story. And in most good stories, there's an element of trauma and there's an element of joy. So I set about telling a great story. Now, if my story in some way re-traumatizes someone, or does something harmful to them, or they start to feel like they might be harmed, they should just leave. They should leave the theater. They should stop reading the story. They should not engage with it. I'm not here to hurt folks, especially Black folks. And I think that we as people, as Black people specifically, we have to decide that for ourselves. You know, I can't watch Fruitvale Station. That doesn't mean it's a bad movie. I cannot watch a realistic story about a Black person who was murdered by the police. I won't watch it, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's just the way that I take care of myself. I'm sure there's joy inside of that story. I'm sure it's gorgeous. But this is a choice that I've made. And I think that the conversation is, I'm gonna put something into the world. I'm an artist, that's my job. Those who receive work can reject anything that I write, and they should, you know? So I don't think that I should not write a story that includes, as On Sugarland does, a Black woman who is dealing with addiction. Because to me, that's dehumanizing. To say to me that I don't get to do that. I've known addiction. Addiction runs in my family. I will write about addiction. I'm just going to do that. Yeah. And if it hurts, then people should take care of themselves, you know? But I also write about joy. And I don't know if you saw this like very eloquent posting that Dominique Morisseau did about Black joy.
I did, yeah.
And about the ways that I feel like that term that she seems to feel, and I agree that that term is being weaponized. Mm-hmm. And it's being a way to sort of, again, introduce, ironically, a brand of respectability politics that dictate that your narrative has to do these things and feel this way. Okay. Now, I'm not going to write a perfectly joyful piece from start to finish, because that is not the kind of theater that I make. My plays have a lot of teeth, as you know, as someone who's experienced them. Yeah. And so I feel that I hope that I know that there are people inside the community who support that. But I don't know. I think it gets tricky for me when I feel like we're telling each other, because I certainly had a reading of This God Is. The first reading, someone said to me, Alicia, what about joy? And I took that back to my mentor, Douglas Kearney, and he just chuckled. And he said, the joy is in the doing. The fact that a Black woman sat down and wrote that play, that's joyous. And there are many ways to experience joy and to be joyous. So yeah, it's complicated, Gabe. That's a great question. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, and also to pick up on that, like the fact that Black theater makers will be able to do this play and have jobs and be employed, like that all comes, that's all joy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so though it's a dark and heavy play in some ways, there's also, it's also bombastic, funny. I think it's hilarious. Yeah. And people write to me all the time. People DM me. I'm so honored that people DM me and tell me how that play has opened things up for them and brought them joy. Yeah. So.
Sure.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode.
Well, now I want to talk about What to Send Up When It Goes Down, a play that you say is for Black people. What was so important to you about creating this piece?
It was important to me to create a space where we could get real about our feelings regarding anti-Blackness. I just hadn't seen that space. It felt like in the theater, a lot of spaces were about, not all of them. I don't want to pretend that I'm the first Black playwright to write a play that's for Black folks. I think that we do that quite a lot. But sometimes I encounter plays that seem like they're actually for white people. They're actually about explaining something about us, our humanity, our culture, sending people on a cultural safari, which is just not my jam. And to me feels dehumanizing. It's like, I have to now in my art, even I have to center your perspective and your gaze. So I really was just angry, Gabe, and sad, and needed a space of affirmation. I needed other people to look me in my face and tell me I wasn't losing my mind. I needed it to be a no gaslighting space. I needed the love of affirmation of you are Black, and there are ways that you suffer because of your Blackness. And we are here, and we are here together, and you can find a way to be, to experience joy in spite of that, to experience love in spite of that. You don't have to sit in grief, and you don't have to just take it, and you don't have to be nice to racists, and you don't have to be nice about racism. So I just needed to make it. I needed to make the thing that I needed.
Yeah.
That's what inspired it.
That's great. And to talk about like the production history, I know you kind of went through a whole lot to get it up in like a theatrical season. So do you want to talk about the early stages of the show?
Sure. So the very, very early stages of this started with me just post-grad school, getting after Trayvon Martin. Actually, I was still in grad school when I started, after Trayvon Martin's murderer. Well, first he was murdered and then his murderer was acquitted. And I just knew I wanted to make something. So I started drafting a thing and I had to find its footing and find out what it wanted to be. And I really was experimental in terms of form with that piece, greatly inspired by the great Nzazaki Shange. And so in the early days, it was just us putting it up at the school that I had gone to and was then teaching at. I just got some friends together. Some of them hadn't even studied acting, Gabe. They weren't actors in the way that you are, no headshots. They had studied like stage management, but I wanted to create a piece that like anybody could come and be a part of and sort of built it on my friends. So it wasn't exactly devised. It wasn't like we played a game and I took down the things they said. I just sort of went, this is what I think this person's skills are. I'm going to write towards those skills. So there are characters that are like my homies that, who weren't in it in New York, but back in post-grad school, it's like that was inspired by who that person is, So yeah, so we started out doing it there at CalArts. And then we took it, and back then I did everything. So I was director, there was a stage manager, costumes were like, everybody put in black. I think somebody stole some black blocks from the theater school for us to use. That was all we had. It was like really built to be sort of nimble and easy to transport and easy to put up. Like it was very intentional about making that theater, just bodies, very minimal props. And so we just took it a few places, the costume shop at ACT, the Harriet Tubman Center for Social Justice in South Central LA. Where else? The theater at Boston Court in Pasadena. And in those early days, it was a draft that no longer is so different to what actually went up in New York. So though I started then, I feel like it didn't finish until like within a few months of what actually went up in New York. And I just kept shifting it and I put it up fully to learn things about it. I didn't go through a bunch of workshopping. That play went up. It just went up, Yeah. And I'm really glad that I did that for myself. So then it ended up at ART in New York. You may know, I'm not sure when you saw it. And that was directed by Whitney White. So that was the more finished version that most people know about. And then of course that production went to Boston and the DC area and toured, came back and went to BAM and then Playwrights Horizons.
Mm-hmm. And all over the country.
And yeah. And now productions are going up all over. It's really thrilling.
Yeah. What role does the audience play in this pageant, this ritual?
The audience's job is to be thoughtful participants, and the audience participation is very low key. There's not a lot that's expected of people. So there are prompts in the beginning of the piece that are, if you have ever seen someone be denied something and you feel that it was because they were Black, take a step forward. That's the level. There's also a moment when people are invited to write a love letter to Black folks living in an anti-Black society, which they, it's very easy. They can do it or not without judgment. So the role is to participate in those moments and then to sit down and to receive, having participated in those moments, having had to think deeply about the ways that the people standing in that room sharing breath with you have experienced anti-Blackness, some of them, having maybe to think about the ways that you've perpetuated anti-Blackness, and that's everybody, even Black folks, then you sit down to receive the work, which is performed as a more traditional piece of theater with the audience sitting and watching this thing take place. And then in the end, there's another moment of call together for community, and the Black people stay in the room at the very end of the piece, and then our non-Black friends exit into the lobby and are read a little note from myself. So I think the job of the audience is to be participants and to be listeners, and is not to just sit back, relax, and receive some play that tells you that racism is bad. It's to really invite you to think about the ways that it's found its way to your spirit, to your doorstep,
Yeah. I always thought that the audience almost plays like that 10th ensemble character in the play. Because they're forced to be active in that way, if they will.
Mm-hmm.
Which they should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
So talk to me about the physical life of not just what to set up when it goes down, but all of your plays. Dance and movement play a really big role in your work. Why is that?
I'm very interested in rigorous articulation of the body in my work. I don't write sit and talk plays. I have very short attention span, and I think I just need, personally, I just like make it move, you know, make it do something. So in Is God Is, people swing a rock and a sock, and the scenes change pretty rapidly. And it just has this sense of urgency that's, you know, written into the text, and I think undeniable. I think it helps to build the kind of suspense that I'm into. I want it to be propulsive. And I think having the bodies articulate themselves in a particular way helps with that. Similarly with What to Send Up, maybe even more so, but in a different manner, because the texture of that piece is quite different. That piece is written to be exhaustive. It is written to force the performers fatigue it creates a fatigue for the performer that parallels the fatigue of dealing with anti-Blackness, the fatigue of like this thing happens again and again. So it's baked into that piece that people, that a movement happens. So that's just one part of the play. And then it happens again. It's many aspects of it are repeated, but it happens faster. So the first version is clipped, is what the stage directions are. And then it just gets even faster. And people are dancing. Step vocabulary has always been a part of that piece, even from those early, early days. There's something about the visceral nature of step and this move that they do that I created like a million years ago that was still in every production, the New York production since. Because there's no substitute, I think, for the viscera of hearing a person's hand hit their body, hit their chest. Obviously, there's references to the heart and the heartbeat, but also culturally, step and like gumboot dance. There are so many things across the diaspora that Black folks do with like hand and like body percussion that are, to me, really important to that piece. Lots of stomping and clapping. And I'm also interested in what I call acoustic theater. I don't think you need 500 sound cues to make a brilliant and compelling piece of theater. I think you can use the voice and the body. I will always feel that the most important aspect of a play, an element of the play, the most compelling part of it is human beings, right? So just use them rigorously. And that of course means the articulation of the body. And with On Sugar Land, the same. There are these extremes, like people who are loopy because they're intoxicated. There's a man whose foot is basically rotting off of his body. There are two elder women who get into a physical tussle and squat and like fight. There's just a lot of there's a lot of expressions of joy and rage and grief that happen through the body. Someone destroys a plant in that play. You know, she could say F you, but like there's something about watching the theatricality of watching a woman destroy a plant that I think is a lot of fun and an exciting turn inside of a narrative.
Yeah, yeah. So to talk about more about On Sugar Land, you know, this play centers around Black community in the South and speaks to war and the military and how to find and escape. Why this play right now in this time?
Well, you should know that this play I started writing like 9 years ago. So it's an old play for me. I think this play for any time, because it speaks to themes that are so large, themes that I think will remain relevant as long as human beings remain upon the earth. Themes like pain and love and loss. So I didn't write it to specifically comment on any particular conflict that the United States engaged with. I wrote it to, well, you know, my mother was in the Army for 20 years. You should know that. I was an Army child. And in some ways, it's kind of like thinking about what it means to have been the child of a soldier and to have been raised in a community with other children of soldiers or other people whose spouses were soldiers or had been soldiers. So it's kind of grappling with legacy in that regard. And then also thinking about what it means for a Black person to serve in the United States Armed Forces, given this country's history of, and not just history, unfortunately, still in contemporary times, of dehumanizing Black folks. And just delving into to the ways that Black soldiers were lynched on site when they would come home in their uniform, just because their the uniform and their sense that they deserved to be treated like humans, which had been affirmed when they were, you know, serving in France, was such an affront to white supremacy that they were really treated poorly, of course, and seen as a threat when they would return home. And some of the Panthers had served in Vietnam. There was something that would happen to, many things would happen to soldiers that emboldened them politically that were really upsetting to people who did not want them to feel the full measure of their humanity. So just, I wanted to think about all of those things. They felt really important. And again, just like filtering this ancient Greek play, Philoctetes, I started out trying to adapt that play. About a soldier who's marooned on an island with an injured foot through my own sensibilities and interests is how I sort of arrived at On Sugar Land.
The youth play a big role in this play. Why is it crucial to you to amplify young voices?
Well, you know, to state the super corny and obvious, the young folks are the future. They're coming up, you know, and they are making the world, and they are actually they are inheriting our triumphs and our failures, just as we inherited the triumphs and failures of those who came before us. The youth also inside of this play embody the innocent spirit of the cul-de-sac. I like to remind myself that each member of the community, including the elder women, at some point would have been part of a rowdy gang of youth before getting older. And that's just a fun reminder. The youth also come to represent the loss that the community endures when folks go off to serve and don't return, right? They start to disappear as the play goes on. And I think, again, we talk about viscera, that's like a visceral way to express the loss. We don't just talk about it. We actually see the absence of these joyous bodies that had sort of invaded the space at the top of the piece.
Yeah. So this being the first production, and knowing now that you wrote it 9 years ago, how much has the script changed from hearing actors speak it from that first rehearsal?
Well, I started it 9 years ago, just to clarify. I've worked on it off and on for 9 years. Okay. So it hasn't been straight through. How much it's changed tremendously, Gabe. Kind of like with Is God Is, how I tried to write one thing and ended up way over here. Same thing with On Sugar Land. The characters have changed. Their language has completely shifted. Who's doing what and why? There's a character who's only spoken of in this version that I had tried to have be Flesh, be the central character, and I just couldn't make it work. So it felt like she was gone. So the playmaking process was really about finding not just the story, but who needed to be inside of it, and how to just propulse things, keep them moving forward. And it just took a long time, but here we are.
Here we are in previews.
That's right.
Yeah. So with the comeback of live theater in the second half of 2021, as an industry, we've been through a good amount of change when it comes to equity, diversity, and inclusion. But what is one change in our traditional way of theater making that you have not seen yet and hope to see soon?
Oh, so many things. I don't know. I think there's one thing that I'm not sure is happening. It's hard to know, Gabe, like what could be happening that I just don't know about. But one thing that I'm sure isn't happening as widely as it should is like pay equity, specifically for writers from like publishers. I know that there are ways and reasons that an entity that publishes plays might pay one playwright more to license their work than another. And I would love for us to like all post what we got paid and call them on the carpet and draw some comparisons, because the word on the street is that white writers are getting so much more than other folks. And I kind of would love to see that laid out, but it's one of those things that people keep really hush hush. And so we don't know. We don't know that such and such got three times as much as we did for our play. So that's one thing that's like a big thing is, I think, and I'm sure there are other versions of that for designers, for, you know what I mean? Pay equity, lay it out. What is that person making who's won the same awards that I've won or less? Do you know what I mean? For their play. So.
Definitely. Yeah. There's so much more of stuff. Oh, that whole idea of like showing receipts, you know, what's going on behind those closed doors. That's really important these days.
Yeah.
So I'm starting this new thing on the podcast where I play this little game, basically like a fill in the blank. So I'll give you the beginning of a sentence and you fill in the rest. So here we go. So we'll start simple. So your favorite pastime is?
Reading.
A show that you'll forever cherish is?
I May Destroy You. Michaela Cole. That's a TV show. Do you want to play? I should give you a play. For color girls who have considered suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough by Intozake Shange.
Yeah. Your favorite writer is?
Toni Morrison.
Black women deserve?
Everything.
If you could spend a day with any artist, it would be?
Nina Simone.
Your greatest achievement was?
Inspiring young people.
You write for Black people because?
I love us.
Blackness is?
Everything.
In one word, On Sugarland is a play about?
Love.
Whitney White is?
Spectacular.
And lastly, Alicia Harris is?
A dreamer.
That was all really great. Cool. So to close here, I always like to ask the artists I speak to, what is your ultimate goal as an artist?
My ultimate goal as an artist is to remind people to be free, especially Black women and femmes, to be free, that there's so much that is working against that, that is saying to be something else. To listen to the intuition and to just stay vibrant and liberated.